Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy, delighted to welcome you to another edition of All Sides Weekend, where we talk about books. And to do that, we have three guests who will tell us their favorites, maybe their not-so-favorites. And we have an author we'll introduce to you who has written already two novels, I'm sure more on the way, as well as a couple of nonfiction books. Beginning with Kevin Griffith, because he's blowing his nose, he is a professor at Capital University and a poet. Welcome, Kevin.
Thanks, Christopher.
Cassie Rose is book critic of WOSU and runs a wonderful blog. Anybody who loves books should go to thelongestchapter.com if you want to know what's great to read. Welcome, Cassie.
Thank you, Christopher.
And Robin Yoakum makes his debut with us this morning on All Sides Weekend Books. He is an author living here in Central Ohio, writing about Ohio, writing about a lot of his own experiences. He's the author of two novels, Favorite Sons and The Essay. Welcome, Robin.
Thanks for having me.
Now, your background is intriguing. You came to writing fiction a bit later in your career. Tell me about what led you to writing fiction.
Well, you know, I had been with the Dispatch for years, and I had written a couple of true crime books. I always tell people, you know, it was a message from God, and that was in that the message came from a publisher in Buffalo who called and wanted me to be a co-author for a book on, instead of executing prisoners with an electric chair, they would take them, or lethal injection, they would take them to the hospital and harvest the organs for transplant. And I said, well, creepiness factor aside, you know, is there enough here to do a book? Said, yeah, this guy's got a lot of great ideas. And I said, well, who is it? And he said, Jack Kevorkian. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, I don't know that my career has tumbled quite that far, and so maybe I'm gonna do fiction. But the reality of it was, you know, for years as a reporter, I'd covered stories, written about the deeds and misdeeds of others. And I was really interested in creating something that was uniquely mine, my ideas, my words.
Tell us a bit where you grew up here in Ohio and your childhood experiences, because unless I'm wrong, some of them are reflected wonderfully in your novels.
Very much so. I grew up in a little town called Brilliant, Ohio, which is, you know, my house was a couple hundred yards from the Ohio River, just south of Steubenville. My dad was a steel worker, and, you know, I grew up in that era when the steel mills and coal mines were booming and kind of a gritty, tough part of the country.
And so were you there when the decline began, when the steel mills began to close down? And
yes, I mean, I was there for the flush times when I was younger. When as I was graduating high school, 1974 was the first year my dad couldn't get me in the steel mill. It was really starting to
so it was like a father-son job that went.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, I mean, now my dad, who was a steel worker, was very somewhat unique in that from the time I was a kid, he was preaching to me to go to college.
Not to go to the steel mill.
There were days when he would come home and the only thing white on him would be his teeth and where his suction goggles had been. And you know, he gave me a tour one day, had me take a tour of Weirton Steel in Weirton, West Virginia. And when I came home, my mom asked me about it, and I said, I'm amazed. And she said, really? And I said, yeah, I'm amazed there aren't about 30 people killed there every day. That's all. That may have been part of his plan to keep me out of the mill, because after I took the tour, I was pretty much convinced that I didn't want to end up there.
Your novel, Fathers and Favorite Sons, has a very interesting genesis you were talking about. Could you tell us what led to that, related to what you were talking
about
before? It's kind of timely now, alas, in the news. So.
Well, yeah, my launch point for that, which when I was with the Dispatch, I went down to Lucasville when death row inmates were housed in Lucasville, and I interviewed a guy named Johnny Spurko. And Johnny was on death row, convicted of killing a female postmaster in Northwest Ohio. And before I left, I took a little tour. They gave me a tour of the death house. And off to the side of the death house, there was a little room with a panel. And on the panel, there was a red, a green, and a white button. And on execution days, three guards, it was volunteer duty but extra pay, would come in. And when the warden gave the signal, all three would push their button. But only one of them was hooked up to the juice that sent the charge to the electric chair. And I wanted to write a book about a prison guard who always, you know, volunteered for that duty. His nickname was the Button Man. And Over time, he develops a friendship with a death row inmate who he believes isn't guilty, and he sets about trying to, you know, right that wrong. So I created the crime for which this guy on death row is going to be wrongfully convicted. And after I did, I really liked these kids. I liked the voice. I wanted to find out what this they cover up a murder when they're young. What happens to them 30 years later? You know, all based on trying to cover up that murder.
Your books are very good at talking about the adolescent young men growing up together, some make their friendships, their lives, not the stereotypical nonsense, although we all know adolescent young men are a drag. But I'm just saying,
right.
But no, but you really are, you're very, very compelling with that. And that's something in both of your books. In the essay, a non-achiever wins a prize and everybody gets on his case about it.
Right. Jimmy Lee, my original idea on that was to have him get out of his environment with football. But it's a little cliche, and since 80% of all books are purchased by females, I didn't want to alienate that. Plus, I thought, you know, it wouldn't surprise you that he's a good football player, but it would surprise you that he can write. And he had never really excelled in school, had never really tried because, as he said, he didn't see a margin in it. Figured he'd go end up in the factories like his dad. And when Jimmy Lee wins the essay contest— Yeah, not only do they think he cheated, but they don't want him representing the school to the larger population of the county.
Why? Because he's a football player, or because he comes from the wrong side of the
tracks? Wrong side of the tracks. He's just a wrong side of the tracks kid who, you know, doesn't know enough at this point in the book to use deodorant or take care of himself. And because while this teacher tries to lift him up, he's got a pretty dysfunctional family, which is always dragging him back the other way.
So you are, would we ever see you writing a novel that's set on Park Avenue?
No, you know, I think you have to write what you know.
Right.
And the book that my agent is currently shopping is set in Eastern Ohio, 1926.
Now, you weren't around then.
No, I wasn't. But it's during a coal mine strike. And it's told through the eyes of my then 13-year-old grandmother.
Really?
So I like, you know, I like Ohio. I like Ohio as a backdrop. It's what I know. You know, I'll probably stick with that.
Robin Yocum is an author who lives in our area. He is the author of two novels, Favorite Sons and The Essay. And talk a bit about your nonfiction books.
The first one was Insured for Murder. And if the people are from Columbus for a while, they'll remember the Just Sweats murder for insurance scam in the late 80s. And Kathy Kandisky, Kathy's still with the Dispatch.
Yeah.
Kathy and I tag-teamed that for about a year, nonstop with the paper, and we turned that into a book called Insured for Murder, which was a lot of fun, you know, and Kathy's great to work with. The second book was Dead Before Deadline. And Dead Before Deadline, we were sitting around one day, a bunch of us, and we were talking about a guy named Ned Stout. And Ned was an old Dispatch reporter, editor, had the most incredible command of the English language of anyone I've ever known. Ned unfortunately had a lot of self-destructive behaviors too. And you know, he was legendary in the newsroom. And I said, I'm going to write down some of these great stories about Ned. And I did that, and I said, well, Bob Ruth, Bob was a reporter there, and I knew some great stories about Bob, and I started writing those down. And I thought, you know, I bet I could do a book here, just short, little, you know, I think the longest story in the book is 6 pages. But it's primarily about my days covering the Dispatch, covering the police beat, the crime beat for the Dispatch. I did that for 4 years. And there were a lot of things that went on behind the scenes that never got in the paper. And that's what it talks about, a lot of the big crime stories in Columbus and just those oddball things that I wasn't able to get in the paper.
And what's your process for writing from the time you get the idea to the time the book is published?
I don't have any particular, one particular, but I will tell you that if I get an idea for a book, the first thing I do is what I just call the brain dump. And I don't worry about grammar, sentence structure, anything else. All I'm doing is trying to get ideas down on paper, because I need to know how that book ends before I really dive into it. I know a lot of writers say they don't do that. They'll start, and the characters tell them how to, and I've tried that. It doesn't work for me. Characters won't talk to me. And so I have to know how it ends. I feel like I can draw the roadmap to get there, but I've got to know, you know, what's out on the horizon. Once I get into that, I'm usually pretty motivated. I try to do, you know, 500, 1,000 words every day. Try to move the ball down the field.
Is it hard to write? I mean, it doesn't sound like much. It's 4 or 5 pages, but every day
it is a grind.
Yeah,
it's an absolute grind. And you know, I travel a lot. I have a PR marketing consulting business, and I spend a lot of time on the road. And I've actually taken to using the dictation device on the Dragon on my cell phone. So I can talk while I'm going, kick around ideas, and email them back to myself so they're there when I get there. So I try
to. Cops ever say, why is this man talking to himself?
Yeah. There's so many people talking into phones these days.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. I don't think it's bothering anyone. So, but I will try. I've been working on a memoir about growing up in the valley when the steel mills were booming. And I finished the draft in about 2 months, because it just. When I get in, you know, I call it the zone, just I guess like a basketball player does, or, you know, and the words are coming, I'll stay with it as long as I can. I'll also write out a sequence. If I'm struggling with a particular chapter or a particular scene, I'll jump to a part later in the book that where the words are coming easier, just to make sure that I'm getting something done every day.
Now, you say that when you begin work or when you're in the early stages, you have to know how the book ends.
Correct.
Because your characters don't talk to you. But have you ever changed your mind?
Oh, very much.
Okay, so will it end differently sometimes?
Favorite Sons is a good example, because, you know, it was going to be about the prison guard to start, and after I got the first 4 or 5 chapters and I really liked those boys, I thought this is going to go a different direction. And I got to figure out how to structure this, how to set it out there.
Cassie Rose and I talked. We all talked about a couple of years ago about a big novel called Matterhorn, which was based on this man's experiences in the Vietnam War. And the reason I'm interested in process is, but didn't he say he sat in the basement for 25 years writing this novel?
It was a long time. It was at least 20 years.
His family had no idea what he was doing down there, and then he almost won the Pulitzer Prize when the thing was published. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Book. We've been chatting with Robin Yoakum, who is an author who was born. Have you always lived in Ohio?
Always lived in Ohio.
Okay. From Brilliant, Ohio, now living in our area, the author of 2 novels and 2 books of nonfiction. He'll be joining our conversation about books with Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith, and your phone calls when we come back. Don't go away. Thank you, Amy Jurevich, our producer. I'm Christopher Purdy. We are back, and Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith and Robin Yoakum are going to talk about some books they've read, they've liked, they want to recommend, they want you to stay away from. And if you would like to get into the conversation, you are welcome to call 292-8513. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. And I have to ask you, Kevin, there you are with a book by Dave Eggers, and his name has been in the news for a while. I mean, he's been a high-profile author. Can you introduce him and this book?
Well, yes, Dave Eggers is a really high-profile author. His first book was a staggering work of heartbreaking genius. He's the editor-in-chief of McSweeney's, or McSweeney's.net, which is a really sort of progressive breakthrough publishing website. He's published a lot of other books, too. Zaytoun comes to mind, and there are many, many
Zaytoun
more.
Zaytoun was about Katrina,
yeah,
right?
That's,
yeah,
that's correct.
It was a nonfiction
very popular book.
Yeah,
and he has wide-ranging interests. They all seem to have some sort of social bent. And his latest book, I would say, is one of the best books of the year. It appeared on a lot of best top 100 lists. It's called The Circle. And it's a little bit different for him. It's written basically as a straight-ahead thriller, dialogue-driven, straight-ahead thriller. And the point of The Circle is interesting. The Circle is an all-encompassing web company. What they've tried to do is take over all social media, banking, finance decisions are all done through this company called The Circle, and some claim that it's loosely based on Google, that a lot of what he took was from Google. And it's the story of this young college graduate. Her name is May. She's just elated that she gets a job with the company. But we soon find out, although May just sort of completely buys into it, like many of us do, it deals with issues of the company basically stealing everybody's privacy. It's a 1984 for the social media age. Their main goal of The Circle is to force everyone to use social media. And it's really creepy. And May at one point becomes a celebrity because she wears a little tiny camera on herself at all times, records everything she does. She records everything she does, and she has all these followers. And there's a scene where she decides she's going to drink a soda, and all of a sudden she gets like thousands of zings, they're called, instead of tweets about, oh, that's really bad for you to drink that soda. We're really upset that you would be harming your body that way.
I want to jump off the nearest cliff.
Oh, yes. That's what happens to her former boyfriend. Her former boyfriend doesn't buy into this at all and tries to live a quote-unquote authentic life in Canada because he doesn't want his business on the web. He wants his life not recorded, and he does commit suicide. That's not a spoiler alert. That happens fairly early in the novel, but that's what he does. And the reason he commits suicide is that The Circle has developed drones. And these drones are supposed to be benign, and they're supposed to be used for good purposes, like to spy on child predators, criminals, that kind of thing. And they use these drones. They make a bet with him that there's no place you can hide, and no matter where you hide, we'll find you with one of our drones. And they do, and he drives off a bridge to get away from them. It's an incredibly good book, and incredibly it's a warning to us all, I think, about the all-encompassing power of the internet and social media.
It's almost like the Twilight Zone.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Really, really disturbing scenes. There's a scene early in the book where she goes kayaking by herself. She wants a few moments of peace, but then she's called into the offices of the upper management at The Circle, and they say, what were you doing kayaking and not taking pictures and uploading them? Don't you know a lot of people like to kayak? Wouldn't you like to know? There's 2,500 people at this corporation that kayak. It's wrong. Basically, their mantra is privacy is theft, that if you keep things private, you're stealing that information from the rest of the public who could use it.
Yeah, the
yes,
way we live
it's
today.
Very Orwellian. It's called The Circle. I'd recommend it. I'm going to use it in all my humanities classes at Capital this semester. Students have to read it and write
sounds
about
like
it.
Sounds like a great and creepy read.
It is.
Dave Eggers, The Circle.
Fast paced, too.
It sounds like it's also a short leap between that from that government to the one in The Hunger Games.
I was just thinking that because you brought us The Hunger Games that have now made Hollywood sensation. My daughter inhaled them after,
catching fires in the movie theaters.
Catching fire, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's when they send them out. They're survival of the fittest, basically.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
But it's the government also that comes in and watches everything, and there is no privacy. You don't have the personal life. And that's why I said it's a short leap between that and that dystopian world.
In this case, the twist is, of course, how easily people buy into this technological totalitarianism, that it's not something being imposed upon them, that they're all willingly sharing all their information.
Sheep.
Yeah.
But also, you get into a peer pressure situation where you can't just say no.
That's correct.
Because everybody's we're all, I think, vulnerable to that, because everybody's doing it,
Yeah.
Cassie Rose, what happened on the 1st of July?
The 1st of July by Elizabeth Speller. The 1st of July 1916 was the Battle of the Somme in France. And it remains, I believe, to this day, one of the worst military days in history for the Brits because they lost so many men and so many were wounded. This is a fascinating fictional account of four men who end up in that battle. And Elizabeth Speller starts it in 1913, following them from their normal lives. There are three Brits and one Frenchman. And one's a store clerk, one's an entrepreneur who goes to New York. The Frenchman is a small boy who leaves his family in a small town in France too because of strife in the family. But anyway, she has these four young men, and each chapter is dedicated to them. And I thought in the beginning of the book, I'm going to have trouble keeping track of all of their details. Well, very quickly, that proved not to be true. And I was up late at night reading the book. because I became so involved with each of these men and the way that she weaves and casts their normal lives and their loves and their desires, one of them to ride the bicycle on long tours and follows the Tour de France, and the entrepreneur in New York who has a huge family estate back in England but holds it secret from his wife because of there's sort of a Downton Abbey kind of thing going on there. But then it comes to the war, and then they get, you know, they sign up, and then it heads toward the Battle of the Somme. It is not a violent, it is not disturbing, it is just so very engaging and human too. And that's, I think, what grabbed me about this was the humanness of these young men and going into battle, and also the history of the battle.
It sounds like it might be, as a writer, easy to do blood and gore, but harder to do what you were just talking about,
yes,
the humanity of somebody who's in an awful situation like that.
Yes, and there is no blood and gore in this. And of course, here we are in 2014, 100-year anniversary of the beginning of World War I. And so I think we're going to see more and more novels about this. This one came out in December, and I hope it doesn't fall off the radar screen. It's really well done, and it's published by a publisher that produces some very, very Pegasus Press, that publishes some really, really well done books. And this is not her first novel.
Her name again is?
It's Elizabeth Speller, The First of July.
Okay. Robert, I want to ask you what you like to read.
You know, I have very eclectic tastes, and I try to read, and in all honesty, I don't read as much as I should, because if I have time to read, I think I ought to be putting words on paper. But I do, I like the epic novels, you know, Ken Follett's Fall of Giants
those,
and Winter World, Winter of the World, which I'm listening to right now. And I actually do a lot of audiobooks now, simply because
they're easier.
And I'm in the car. I spend so much time in the car and when I'm writing. I will say a book that didn't get a lot of attention nationally is a book, a memoir that I read recently, I really liked, called Burn Down the Ground. It's by a woman named Cambry Cruz, and it's about her. It's based, she read The Ice Castle and thought, that's my story. And she was raised in the wilds of Texas by two deaf parents. Her dad's in prison now for attempted murder. And it is just the oddball, wild things that went on in her life. But if people like The Ice Castle, I like The Ice Castle better, but I still thought Burn Down the Ground by Cambry Cruz was a nice memoir.
Do you have trouble, or is there a challenge for you reading novels, and let's say a mystery or crime that would be something similar to what you do, that you get the voice mixed up in your head? Do you find yourself, if then you turn to write, that it influences you?
I don't. That's a great question. I will say this. James Lee Burke, who does the Dave Robichaux novels, and which I really like, if anyone said what one writer has influenced you, I would probably say James, simply because my worst trait as a writer is my incredible impatience. And I don't know if it was from years at the Dispatch where you're just churning out stories and moving, or I'm just naturally impatient, which I think is more likely the case. When you read James Lee Burke, and even though he writes mysteries and he's a great storyteller, I think he's also a very good writer, and he slows down the narrative to where you have to stop and visualize what's going on, you know, around. And that has helped me as a writer, because it's forced me to step back, look at what I've written, take some time, polish it, and take a little bit slower approach.
Here's a wonderful email from Frances. This is a great question. She's currently writing her autobiography. Would any of your guests have any suggestions as to where or how to find a publisher? Mm. I'd have a blog. That's what I do.
Well, right.
It's a lot of hard work. I mean, you basically, your first bet, and Robin can probably speak from experience about this, but it's, you know, to go for an agent first.
Is it harder to sell a novel or a nonfiction book?
Novel.
Novel.
Yeah, you think?
I think.
Yeah.
Yes, it is definitely a novel.
Yeah.
I would help out Francis just by saying this is what I tell my students. If you're just sort of interested and want to put your foot in the water just a little bit and look for possible agents or publishers, or you don't want to deal with an agent, go to pw.org, poetsandwriters.org, pw.org. Very good. It's a very good resource. It's a magazine. You can also buy it in Barnes & Noble or whatever, but the website's free, and they have a directory and calls for submissions and that kind of thing, so she might be able to find some outlets there.
And also to look at some autobiographies that have been published and look at the publishers who is publishing that kind of a biography and look toward them. And you can still send in and try and get into the slush pile. And also read in the acknowledgments sometimes that they will list the name of the editor that they have worked with.
292-8513 is the number if you'd like to call in and get in on the conversation. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. I'm just going to throw this up because you were talking about the epic novels, and I'm with you. I'm very fond of those. Everybody was writing about a book called The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt. Everybody was raving about this book. It was on the best of all these lists. And I don't know if any of you have read it, but it is a great epic novel. Everybody sits Dickensian. And yeah, well, it is, but it's contemporary New York. But if you haven't read it, I would recommend that as well. Does anybody know this woman, Donna Tartt? Because apparently she's a real cult kind of a figure.
Well, she started out with The Secret History many years ago, and it takes her 10 years to write a novel. So she started with The Secret History, then it was The Little Friend, and now this, The Goldfinch. And The Secret History was a bestseller. She really hit a home run with that one, too. It took place in a private school. And then with The Little Friend, at least critically, took a dive down.
There went those 10 years you're not going to get back.
Right. And, you know, to her point, she holds to it. You know, publishers will push on authors to get their next book out and do it quickly because they're looking at the bottom line. And Donna Tartt, you know, holds to it. If it takes her 10 years, it takes her 10 years. Well, then she comes out with this third book and The Goldfinch, you're right, it has just gone stratospheric and is hitting all the awards, at least being shortlisted. She's certainly shortlisted on the National Book Critics Circle award that will be announced.
It's going to be
another
Meryl Streep movie, I'll bet you.
Probably. But she is very, very good. And it's a testament to authors, too, that, you know, her second book was not that good. And yet she comes back with a third, and it is outstanding. And this is how publishers used to work with authors. They would journey with them. They would stick with them through their ups and their downs. And now the expectations are so high that if your second novel tanks, it's very hard to get the third out.
It's like having a bad picture. Yeah.
Yeah.
No
right.
good. You all come in every time we do this because I ask you to, but you did anyway, with huge stacks of books for us to talk about. And you both, all three of you, I'm sure, read a great deal. So how do you choose what you bring us, Kevin?
Well, I go through a lot of different books, and I've told you this before. We're both big patrons of the Whetstone Library. I just go and scan the new bookshelves and see what looks good. I'll look through, I'll pick up a bunch of books, look through the first 10, 20 pages, see if anything rings a bell or resonates with me.
Can you tell from the first couple of pages if you want to read this book?
Usually. Yeah. So often you can tell if it's just going to be formulaic or tiresome or if the prose, I'm a big fan of prose style, sorry, pretentious me, but if the sentences aren't well written or they don't seem to stand out
well,
or anything.
I mean, you are paid to make sure we do that.
I toss it away. And then other times, you know, I hear things on NPR or I have students will turn me on to things or my own son or daughter will pick up a book and say, you ought to check this out. You know, you ought to reconsider this. We were talking before, one of the great books I reconsidered was The Fault in Our Stars by John Green, which we had mentioned was going to be made into a movie. Initially, when I read that, I thought it was just a wee bit too clever for its own good, too cloying. But I reread it and I stuck with it this time. And it's a great love story, The Fault in Our Stars, about Augustus and Hazel. And they both have cancer. I don't want to go into too much detail because I don't want to spoil it for people. But it's a fantastic love story, well written, fast paced. And if you're a book lover, they're both book lovers, and they travel to Holland to visit a reclusive writer named Peter Van Houten, who's written this book that Hazel just loves. And when they get there, they find out he's a real jerk, but they fall in love, so that turns out okay. It's sort of the love story for the 16, 15-year-old set. And but John Green, he's from Kenyon College. That's where he went as an undergraduate. He's a local guy. Good writer, very good, many, many really good sort of witty cultural references in there. One of the characters wears a T-shirt that's Magritte's This Is Not a Pipe on it. So I was very fond of that. So there's a lot of those little college-y things in it that I just love. So that's
and,
good.
And even
it's
though
good
it's
to
about
it.
Cancer, mm-hmm. it's cancer from an adolescent's viewpoint. It's not from the adult, that worried, burdened,
this is it, yeah.
this is it kind of thing. Yeah. And so that's what's refreshing about it. Mm-hmm. It's their viewpoint and how the parents are reacting, how the doctors are reacting. And it's very, very popular. And for me, every time I got to the end of a chapter, I had to keep reading the next one.
The Fault in Our Stars by John Green. And Cassie, how about you? How do you decide what you're going to bring us?
I think of someone coming up to me, because a lot of people approach me and say, can you recommend a good book? Or I go to book clubs, too, and talk with them and recommend books. And I think I have to be able to stand by this and feel that whatever I talk about, I know that it's a really, really good book that someone's going to get involved in. And there are many books that I pick up and read. In fact, there was one I was reading last night, and it's a collection of essays called What Happens Next, Iowa Press, won some awards. Good book, but I thought I'm not going to bring it to the show to recommend it, simply because there's some gut instinct I have that many people would find it to be boring. And because it is, it's very slow going. It's not something that I would say, you've got to pick up this book next. And so there are many books that I don't bring to the show because of that, because I may critically recommend it, say it's well done, well written, but maybe the reading population would find it to be dry or cloying or something. Mm-hmm. So what's critically good is not necessarily a good page-turner or an involving literary novel. So it's really a gut instinct, and it's also a very, very good story I look for.
Give me a page-turner from your stack today. Give me something that really has grabbed your attention.
This one did, The Collector of Lost Things by Jeremy Page. And it's got historical pinnings to it. It's set in 1845. And where my head is going is, why is this a page-turner? And it's a page-turner because it is so involving. It's not a page-turner like Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn. It's a page-turner because of the setting. It is in the Arctic Ocean on a ship. It is 1845, and the protagonist, Elliot Saxby, is going in search of the great auk, which is a bird that is now extinct. Well, it was thought to be extinct back then, and he's going to prove a bet by some Englishmen in a pub to say, is the bird really gone? So he gets on this trade ship that is heading to the Arctic Ocean, to this small island where the great auk was last seen. And on the ship is a sociopathic captain and also a gentleman hunter and his cousin, because it's a hunting ship. And the cousin is a woman that Elliot Saxby, the protagonist, believes he fell in love with 10 years ago. He knew her as Celeste. She's on the ship as Clara. So there's romance. There is just dysfunction because of the sociopath. There's also a lot of ethical information going on here, because this was a time when creatures were plundered for human use. And it's well written. It is also in this atmosphere of the ice enclosed. And human beings feel very vulnerable in that, and the frigid and the frigid temperatures. So there's much that this author does with the intrigue of about the bird, the great auk, a conspiracy that goes on around that, the romance, the drama among the characters on the ship. It's that kind of involving read that I like to bring here.
Well, I thank you for that. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I've always said, and I'll say it again, if Cassie Rose recommends a book, read it, because she's never wrong. I'm telling you that right now. The Collector of Lost Things. We have to take a break. We're back in 90 seconds with more of All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy. Don't go away. I I've given the phone number a couple of times, and if I'm not picking up your calls, it's because I'm so into this conversation that I haven't been looking at the screen. So I apologize if people have been holding and hanging up. I do mean it. Call us, but I'm just sort of myself just absorbing of the great information we have from our guests, Kevin Griffith from Capital University, who is a poet, Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic, whose blog is The Longest Chapter, and Robin Yoakum, an author. His two novels are Favorite Sons and the essay Robin has been writing about Ohio, which is his home, birthplace, and where he still is. Can a novel come from one tiny little otherwise silly germ or idea?
Both of mine have. And
like an extinct bird.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, as we talked about Favorite Sons and my launch point from that, and I remember my grandmother, the one we're trying to sell right now, about a coal mine strike. I remember my grandmother telling me as a kid about a coal mine strike in which the coal mine operator went down to Alabama, Mississippi, and got unemployed black men who had lost their jobs due to automation in agriculture, put them on a cattle car and brought them north to break the coal mine strike. Now, that's all she told me. That was the only little nugget, you know, that I remember. But that's basically what I wrapped this new novel around, was that one little germ of an idea.
But I did love that line that you said about an extinct bird equals a novel. Kevin, I want to ask you about, I saw this book in Whetstone Library, and I, like you, will look at, if it looks mm-hmm. compelling, I will take it down in the new rack and read it. It's called Morrissey, and I heard two things. It was about a rock musician, and stupid me, I'm going, Jim Morrissey, The Doors, because I'm that age, but I'm also getting senile because it's Jim Morrison, and that's not who we're talking about here.
No. This is James Patrick Morrissey's autobiography. It just came out. Morrissey was voted, believe it or not, by the BBC the second greatest living British icon behind Sir Richard Attenborough.
Where's the Queen?
That
in all
means
this,
yes, and where's Paul McCartney?
Well,
he
Paul
beat
McCartney,
out Paul
yes.
McCartney.
Yep.
Morrissey is the name of James Patrick Morrissey, and Morrissey was the lead singer of the Smiths, and he also had a very long, illustrious solo career. He's the only musician ever to have a number one album in three different decades in Great Britain. It's been around a long time. His hits aren't that big in the United States, although he has had some top 40 hits. Just to get to the book, though, if you like a book, even if you didn't know anything about him, this is an incredibly well-written autobiography. I would put it up on the level of Patti Smith's Just Kids, and not surprisingly,
that's a great book.
Yes, this is the same level. This is, you're getting much more than just the tawdry drug, sex, and rock and roll. In fact, he was very famous for not doing drugs, and he had really no interest in sex at all. And you're thinking,
why is he writing a book? Who
yeah,
cares?
Well, he's great. He talks about his childhood. He grew up, of course, in a very rough section of England and never made it out of, really dropped out of grammar school, and taught himself just by listening to the hits, studied Patti Smith very carefully, was involved in the British punk scene. But what's fascinating about this is there are long stretches in this novel where he talks about, and of course I like this, it appeals to me, poets who influenced him. And he has a long section on A.E. Houseman and A.E. Houseman's struggles with being a gay man. I didn't know that. Yes,
yeah.
And Morrissey is
that wasn't
gay
invented
as well.
Until 50 years ago.
That's right.
But
that's what he's talking about before the invention of that, and he looks at his poetry very careful and finds these subtle clues about how the enormous suffering of a person who can't find someone to love or doesn't have the approval of society. But he's a very witty writer, too. Just to give you one example, he was talking about a concert he did at UCLA, sold out, and a riot ensued at this concert. And later in his hotel room, he's watching the newscast about this riot. And the newscaster said, well, apparently after Morrissey said, come on, let's party, and invited people up to the stage, there was a riot. And then Morrissey just writes, you know, the idea that I would say something as jejune as come on, let's party, made me want to...
Imagine Keith Richards using the word jejune.
Yeah, and he says, made me want to spray my hot toddy into the television screen. The guy is just fantastic. He's a fantastic writer, just a real witty guy. And you can see why the Brits love him. And that's James Patrick Morrissey. And I'd strongly recommend, if you want to read a real high-quality autobiography on the level of Patti Smith's Just Kids, Morrissey.
And if you're waiting for it from the Columbus Public Library on your list, Kevin has it. So you can call him up on the phone and say, return the damn book. Morrissey is your choice for a really compelling autobiography. You know, a lot of great famous people with very interesting lives write their own stories, and 80% of them are boring as books. Mm-hmm. They don't really work as books. Can anyone think of another autobiography that really grabs you? It doesn't have to be a famous person.
The one that comes to mind, but I read it centuries ago, is one by Arthur Rubinstein.
Yes.
I got that as, I think it was a graduation gift from high school.
My young years.
Yes, and I loved it. I loved it about the concerts everywhere. He was the one, too, where he would fly in his piano to
he liked wine, women, and song a lot, not necessarily in that order. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had a very, he was married to a young woman in his 90s, so he had a very, very compelling life, aside from being a great musician. How about you, Rob?
You know, there was one book that sticks in my mind, and gosh, it's been years ago. It was one called When All the Laughter Died in Sorrow. And it was about an NFL football player named Lance Rensel, and who was married to Joey Heatherton.
Right,
you remember?
Yeah.
I mean, and
70s icon.
He got caught a couple times exposing himself, and it was this sort of this story of a guy who, at least on the surface, before all this broke, you know, had absolutely everything in the world and tormented by demons.
I have to go look. I wonder if he's still with us, because that was a long time ago.
That was a while ago.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he is or not.
But I remember that was notorious, case back in the day. That's right. What about books that you have heard of coming out? Are we creating buzz about anything we're waiting for?
You know, that's an interesting question right now, because I have been thinking I don't see any great books coming out right now. And I don't know why, but I can tell that. I can see it on the reading table that I have, where I line up the next books I'm going to be reading, the books that are coming in, and there's just not anything there. And I'm like, am I not looking hard enough or whatever? But that's usually a signal. I've been doing this long enough. Something is not happening right now or in February. And it does happen. There are peaks and valleys. And I just don't see just a lot of great books coming out this month or next.
Do you think publishers today believe among themselves that there's only time for one blockbuster at a time?
No, because I've seen that disproven. That was probably not this past fall, but the fall before. We had a massive onslaught of big name authors that were hitting. And I remember it because it was, who do you read? Who, you know, is it too much? Because they'll then be competing for reading time among each other. I just think that sometimes, especially after Christmas, I think that sometimes the book publishing, it doesn't really slow down, but they calibrate how they bring out the books. And, you know, as I say this, I can tell you that Matthew Quick, who is the author of Silver Lining Playbook, his new book is coming out in February, and that's getting a lot of buzz, and it already has a movie option with it. And I'm looking forward to that. I know Laurie Moore has a collection of short stories coming out in February, which I'm looking
forward
to.
She has a local connection, too. She was on the guest faculty at OSU for a number of years, I think.
Yes.
Right? Yeah,
so, and I can also say one other, a book coming out on Tuesday, Orfeo, by Richard Powers. Richard Powers is a MacArthur genius. He has won National Book Award. He's got the same themes going on, music and science. But this one I'm reading, and again, this is what I'm reading as forecasts, that he brings the emotion in much better.
Times Book Review didn't like it last week.
Oh, they didn't?
Not that they're right, but I'm just saying. They didn't like it. But, yeah, you know, just that's all the more reason to read this new book by Richard
Powers. But he's got a fan club.
He does, indeed.
So, you know, there's a huge fan following there. So, again, that's a signal that you need to be really sure that this is the kind of story and writer that you want to get into with this book. If it's a first time, you need to do your due diligence.
Well, let me ask each of you, what book are you getting ready to read, or what book have you never read that you really, really want to get to at some point in your life? Kevin?
I want to get to the Donna Tartt novel that you talked about, The Goldfinch. That sounds good. I began it. But when we're talking about these epic length novels, sometimes it's like, man, I just don't have the energy here.
this is a page turner.
This is worth the energy. Okay, yeah. So that would be the one.
Okay.
The one that I want to read next is Bernard Malamud's A New Life, because it is not one of the ones that was on the radar screen, and I've read that it is his Richard Yates novel.
Now, what does that mean?
Well, it's like Revolutionary Road by Richard Yates.
Describe that, because that's a very creepy, wonderful book.
Oh, it is a great book. It's about, it's the 50s, right? Where and it follows a couple, and it very much captures the lifetime of the, or the a couple's lifetime at the time, in the marriage.
They live in Connecticut. He commutes to New York. They don't have children, I don't think, but
So Jonathan Lethem, is in the introduction, says
Dissident Gardens, by the way. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yes, he says that this is his Richard Yates novel about that. But it's about a guy who leaves the East Coast and he goes to the West Coast to start a new life as a professor. Something about it, I want to read it just like I wanted to read Evelyn Waugh's A Handful of Dust.
That's a great book.
It is a great book. But Brideshead Revisited is the one that gets the most press,
right,
and people miss this one. That's what I think is going on with A New Life, with Bernard Malamud, and why I want to read
it. If it's not a miniseries, it's going to be harder to find, probably. Or harder to be popular. I don't know.
Maybe.
How about you, Robert?
See, I think next on my list is Destiny of the Republic by Candace Millard.
That's a great book.
And it's, I've got books lined up that I've been trying to get to. And I think that's next. And then Light of the World by James Lee Burke is in there. And I am still trying to do, I was not a big, big reader growing up. So I've tried to go back and reread or read a lot of the classics. And Faulkner, I'm trying to get back and to do some Faulkner. And
you've got to choose. Right. Don't just grab any.
I didn't have a good time.
I wouldn't start with The Sound and the Fury.
I didn't have a good time.
That is the one. Sound and Fury was the one.
We've talked about that.
I just tried to read, and I put it down three different times. I want to smack myself over the head with a book.
I want to smack him.
Start with Absalom, Absalom.
Yeah, maybe I'll.
Okay. Yeah,
I've read a couple of Faulkner books, and obviously it's me, not him, that has the problem. But it's, I haven't had a great time getting in there. But we've learned the hard way not to denigrate a book like that, because when I said on the air that Moby Dick was boring, we got mail. So Moby Dick was wonderful.
Well, I think sometimes it's easier to read the classics when you are having instruction in college, because you're reading a chapter or two at a time, and then you're going to class, and the professor is taking you through it, or you're reading the whole book or whatever.
I've had the opposite, being a professor, unfortunately, but I've had the opposite experience. I understand what you're saying. When you're held accountable, you'll get through it. But I always thought, at least when I was an undergraduate, sometimes those great books were ruined by the professor forcing you. When I wasn't forced to read them, then I really enjoyed them. So that's kind of a switch there. So.
I was in college, and I had to read David Copperfield. And when you're a freshman in college, you don't feel like reading a long, you think have better things to do, like sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Yeah, that's right.
But I'm grateful to this day that I read David Copperfield when I was 17 years old, because it's just one of the most beautiful books that I know. I'm in the middle of Walden right now, because I'm from that area of Massachusetts where Thoreau was writing, where Walden Pond is. I used to skate on Walden Pond, but most of us who grew up there have no clue what that book is. And it's one of the most modern 180-year-old books you will ever read. I mean, he was telling the future. I think he proves with that book that things change very little.
One that I recently discovered that was forced upon me as a kid, and I didn't come back to it till a couple weeks ago, is Picture of Dorian Gray. I'd forgotten. That is a
Oscar
great
Wilde.
Book. Oscar Wilde. What a wit machine he is.
I mean, he is,
Every single line of dialogue in there is just one of his little witty epigrams, basically.
They often mean a lot more than what's on the page.
Oh, of course. Yeah, there's so much going on in that novel when you see it from an adult's eye.
We have to say goodbye. I do thank you all. Thank you, Robin Yocum, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I look forward to having you back with us. Cassie Rose, as ever, if she says read it, read it. The longestchapter.com is her blog. Kevin Griffith keeps us all adults, and it brings us a rock biography, too. So thank you very much for you all. I'm Christopher Purdy. This has been All Sides Weekend Books. I thank you all for listening. Keep reading.